across the state. If the clerk will please announce council.
Judgment and the engagement case, they were both
burglary of a habitation basis, and that evidence and proof in the engagement case was so intertwined with that in the unlawful possession of firearm by a felon case, I don't think you can sufficiently separate the two to do any kind of separate harm analysis there. So it's our contention that he should be granted a new trial in that case based on that error. As far as the unlawful possession of firearm by a felon case, that was the cornerstone. That was the proof of the underlying predicate felony, proof of his status as a felon. That was a quintessential exhibit that the state admitted to meet that element of proof. And if you look at the indictment in the case, the state specifically pled that clause number from the 211 Judicial Court, District Court of Denton County, Texas, that clause number everything. So the state pled it. The exhibit should not have been admitted, so they would have failed to prove it had the trial judge not abused his discretion and excluded it. So that's why we're asking to reverse and render a judgment of acquittal in that case. The second topic I would like to address is the jury charge issue. The jury charge issue specifically with regard to the joint possession instruction. Most recently, most on point, I think, obviously, is the Court of Criminal Appeals decision, Kirsch versus State, that came out about operating. And it's clear as day now that trial court is not supposed to include extra statutory jury instructions, definitions, in its charge to the jury.
There should not be a joint possession instruction given at all, and that
would expect for each side, the state to say, yes, we're doing possession, and evidence is sufficient, and have to convict. Just like you'd expect the defense to argue, no, there wasn't joint possession, here was all his or her, the other was quick. Does that make it clear? As far as the last and biggest issue, I think, especially constitutionally, is the Chevron issue. That's the one that's huge and that's egregious in this case. It's clear from the sequence of events, from the record in this case, that the trial court was anything but very sure of the actions when he ordered the shackling at the outset of the country. There are generalized references to security concerns and the fact that appellant had been convicted of these offenses. And that's it at the beginning. And you have appellant's lawyer, trial lawyer, objecting at the end. As everyone well knows, you have to have more than that. You have to have specific, justifiable, and articulate reasons to order shackling. And this is a case where it's not shackling that no one can see. It's a shackling where everyone, at every step of the way, trial court, the bailiff, the bystander, still with exception, the state, even in its brief, concedes that shackling would be seen, maybe not hands, legs, and feet, but you can see it hands being shackled. The word that's in the record is apparent, that it was apparent to the jurors.
Which word is it?
I'm in agreement, I guess, with Deck and all the other court cases. How genuine security concerns were, anything like that, if you do a complete about face, and in the same exchange there in the record, the state says it doesn't matter at this point. And that was absolutely true. I agree with that statement because you can't unsee what you've already seen.
So I guess one could argue, being the devil's advocate, that the trial judge could have erred by unshackling him if his reasons for shackling him were articulated correctly.
I think that what the cases stand for is that you have to articulate and have those reasons prior to doing it. I don't think you can have it done and then go back after the fact and then do it, and especially when you've reversed yourself. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Rowland. Ms. Simmons.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. First of all, I did want to mention to the court, I've been practicing here for 6 years, and this is probably my last appellate argument, and I just wanted to thank you all for the experience. This was my first job as an attorney, and I've now moved over to the juvenile division at Denton County, but I held on to this case because I've been doing it for about 3 years now. So
we will miss you.
But I wanted to thank you all very much for the opportunity in this court. Starting off first with the 1981 judgment that was admitted by the state during the trial below, the state did offer the prior judgment to prove that appellant was a felon at the time that he possessed the firearm in this case, and also to enhance the punishment range for the engaging in organized criminal activity offense. The state had fingerprint analysis done and connected the prior judgment to appellant at the time of trial. And at that time, we made our case of proving that he was the person, in fact, that was in the prior judgment from 1981. At that point, the appellant's attorney did argue that there was no certification. I do not believe that blanket, there's not a certification in the prior judgment, was sufficient for him to have made an affirmative showing, which is required. However, the trial court did inquire further as to whether or not there was proof that he was certified as an adult. The state conceded throughout the trial that he was a juvenile at the time of the 1981 offense. There was no question about that. At the trial court's request, small recess was taken, and the state obtained the district court's file from 1981. In there, there was not a certification order. However, there were other documents that were filed that indicated he had already been certified as an adult, and they were requesting an examining trial prior to going to the grand jury. And then there was also a recorded statement for fees by appellant's trial attorney that said he had reviewed all of the certification documents at issue certifying him as an adult, and then charging the fees for those prior to him leaving representation as a juvenile attorney on behalf of appellant. At that point, the judge felt that the state had offered enough evidence to prove that there had in fact been a certification. The appellant's attorney continued to object that there was a lack of evidence and that more needed to be shown. However, the judge overruled that. The state's argument is that once that we've made that prima facie showing of a proper judgment, any defect that's going to be raised by the appellant at that time, he has a duty to make an affirmative showing of a valid defect, making it void. In this case, he did not do anything such as bringing forth a juvenile court file showing that there were no documents that certified him as an adult or that any step of the process was missing. Basically, he just made verbal statements that the state didn't make their showing, therefore it was a void judgment, and that's just not the way that the case law requires it. Once we've made our prima facie showing, the burden then shifts for him to make an affirmative showing otherwise, which he failed to do, and rather tried to shift the burden back to the state that we needed to just continue to prove more without him proving anything otherwise.
And wouldn't the lack of a certification, if we were back in 1981, been a question to have been raised at or near that time or on appeal then, because perhaps the judgment would have been only voidable? In other words, you have to go behind the judgment to look and see if a certification was in existence.
Absolutely. Had there been any question as to any of the process, moving a juvenile into an adult system and charging them as such, there would have been issues raised in the trial court or on an appeal or in a writ any time thereafter. And this was not an issue that was raised until it was raised by appellant at the time of trial. There were no pretrial hearings, as I recall, relating to it. It was at trial, and the state moved as quickly as possible to grab what documents were available in the court. But as you know, in this day and age, it's kind of hard to locate the specific documents from a 1981 case on the fly. Most of those are sent off to other buildings for storage, if they even exist anymore. And because this case was transferred from a juvenile court to an adult court, it made it that much more complicated because the courthouse does not have any of the juvenile documents. Those are all located in a separate building, and none of those attorneys or judges were present in the court at this time. Furthermore, even if this court were to find that there was an issue relating to the 1981 judgment, which I do not believe there was at all, I don't believe that he would have suffered any harm anyway. As far as the unlawful possession of a firearm, even if you were to say that at the time of trial that they found it to be void due to a defect, the statute or the case law states basically that it has to be, we have to prove that he was a felon in possession at the time he possessed the firearm. Much like she said in the Jimenez, that she thought it applied better in a writ, because if you later go back in a writ case and you find it that was subsequently void, you can still go back and say, but at the time he possessed that firearm, it was not a void judgment. At that time, as far as he was concerned, the law was concerned, the courts were concerned, he was a felon in possession. You can go back and void that prior judgment, but it does not have an effect on specific cases such as an unlawful possession of a firearm, because at that time it was not a void document. It wasn't void until it was attacked. Here it wasn't attacked until trial. At that time, we're not alleging he's a felon. Even if you were to say it was void, we weren't proving that day in court that he was a felon in possession of a firearm today. But we're alleging back when he possessed that firearm, he was a felon for all purposes, because no one has attacked that judgment prior to him possessing that. Any other finding would lead any person to be able to say, if they're being arrested for an unlawful possession of a firearm, that there's no proof that there's a valid, that there really are a felon, because even though they haven't attacked the case yet, they could in the future. So I don't believe that you can use that to your advantage and say that it was okay to break the law because we now find that judgment that made you a felon is invalid. Secondly, as counsel indicated, if the 1981 judgment were void, obviously it would affect it, the engaging in organized criminal activity case, because we used it to enhance punishment. And there's no getting around that we couldn't have enhanced punishment with a void judgment at trial. Then again, I don't believe this 1981 judgment was void. I don't believe that appellant's counsel carried his burden and that the state went above and beyond by even reshouldering the burden at a time when it should not have been shifted back to us. We went above and beyond and bringing the court more documents to prove our case.
Ms. Simmons, I'm sitting here kicking around in my mind what you said about the certification. And did I hear you say that you never found that there was a record of a certification?
In the file that we received from the district court, there was no proof in the district court's files of the proceedings that occurred in the juvenile court, because at that point, certification had already been found. The district court's file merely shows motions from both parties indicating he has been certified for an adult. That's why we're in this court.
Say it had already been found. Where was it found, and how did you know it had been found?
It had been found in the juvenile court, which can be presumed by the fact that we are now in an adult court, and both the state and the appellant's attorneys are filing documents stating that certification was found in the juvenile court.
And therefore, there was the proof in the district court in the case that is the one that's attached as Exhibit 63 here is the contentions on the part of the attorneys in that case, because no one said he hadn't been certified.
That is the proof that was in the district court's file. And it is the state's argument that we had already made our prima facie showing of that the appellant was connected to the 1981 judgment. And for anyone to argue a defect or a void judgment, they then have the burden of making that affirmative showing. What in this case, as in other cases, which I've cited in my brief, what often happens, if in fact there truly is not a certification, the appellant then will bring forward the juvenile file and then indicate therein, as you see in this file, there's no transfer order, none of these steps were taken in the juvenile court, thus this is improper. And there are cases that have held that the certifications did not occur, and that was proven on an affirmative, when the respondent or the appellant made an affirmative showing that there was, those materials were absent from the juvenile file. Here, appellant's attorney dropped the ball and made no affirmative showing of any type other than saying the state needs to show us more. I'm not going to show you anything, but the state needs to keep bringing you more and more stuff to prove their case, when in fact we'd already proven our case.
All right, so in essence, you're making the walks like a duck, talks like a duck, must be a duck argument. He's in district court, must be an adult. The lawyers are referring to him as an adult in district court, must be an adult, therefore he must be an adult. That's kind of the bottom line.
Yeah, that basically sums it up. His own attorney said he's a duck. I mean, you would think if he wasn't a duck, his own attorney, or even he, someone would have said, I'm not a duck. There wasn't one person since 1981 who said he wasn't a duck up until this moment in trial when we did not have the juvenile file in our hands. And I believe if it truly wasn't a certification, appellant's attorney would have brought the juvenile file to court and proved so. He didn't bring the file to court because he knows very well if he had obtained that file, there would have been proof of a certification. It was more of smoke in the courtroom trying to muddy up the waters.
Thank you for answering my question.
Thank you, Your Honor. Moving on to the joint possession issue. As to that issue, the court did specifically define possession pursuant to the penal code, and it's true that joint possession is not an issue, is not a term that's defined by the court or by the penal code. In this case, one of the defendant's main arguments throughout trial was to insinuate via cross-examination of witnesses that Mr. Stevens, the second person in the vehicle where all the guns were found, had relinquished his rights to those, forfeited his rights to those guns in federal court, and continuously would make that point and say, so he forfeited his rights. Mr. Ross didn't forfeit his rights to those guns, right? Those are not his guns. He forfeited his rights because they were his guns. That's how the law goes. And that was a constant argument that if he relinquished rights, then he must have possessed those guns because that's how possession works. He possessed them. You can't relinquish it without possessing it. And that was the defendant's argument throughout trial. The state did request that the jury be instructed as to joint possession, that more than one person can possess an item. Therefore, you, just because you've relinquished your rights doesn't mean another person can possess the same gun. If this court were to find that there was an error in the instruction on joint possession, there was so much overwhelming evidence in this case as to appellant's possession of the gun. Stevens and appellant were both, there was a takedown at a Walmart. And both of these men were in the car together. It's appellant's wife's car. The gun in the trunk is, one of the guns is his wife's gun, which he was present when she purchased the gun. The other gun, he has been seen by a witness who testified buying laser lights to put on that gun and special police holsters to carry the gun. One of the guns was located in a suitcase which was locked. The key to that suitcase was on the appellant's key ring to the car that he was driving. The other suitcases in the back of the car, one of them had a name tag for an airline ticket on the bag that had his name in it. The third bag had a Nigerian newspaper celebrating the birth of his daughter. The bags and all of the suitcases in the back of the trunk were appellant's bags. They were all linked to him. The guns were in appellant's bags. There was overwhelming evidence that those were his guns. The only gun that in the car that we believe was not his gun was Stevens' gun that was found in between his legs when he was arrested. We did not charge appellant with the possession of that gun. And we believe that Stevens, the evidence showed that appellant picked, called Stevens and said, I'm going to come by and pick you up. And so it would be easy to determine that he picked Stevens up. Steven kept his gun with him at the foot of the car. He didn't place it in the trunk. He was not in the trunk. He had his gun with him and was ready to go. Appellant's gear was in the trunk.
I thought there was one on the floorboard.
In the floorboard, that was Stevens' gun.
Between his legs in the sense of...
Yeah, he had it on the floorboard of the front passenger, and appellant was not charged with that gun. Appellant was only charged with the guns that were in the suitcases in the back of the car, and all of those suitcases were linked to him sufficiently. Secondly, if there was any error as to the joint possession, it did not apply to the other. It didn't harm him when the state made any reference to it in final argument, because the only argument they made was in regard to the guns that were found at a house that Ross shared with Stevens also, and he was found not guilty of those, possession of those guns. So it further goes to show that there really wasn't too much harm from it. I see that I'm out of time and I'm rambling, so if the court has no further questions, I'd ask that you affirm the trial court's judgment in the case below, and thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Simmons. Ms. Rowland, rebuttal.
Yes, ma'am. I'd like to direct your attention first off with the 1981 judgment, the reference in the record to where you'll find the discussion about that is in Volume 8, pages 102 to 104. And it's also outlined in the reply brief, too, so if you want, that's easier. But with regard to the state's assertion that once the burden shifted and appellant essentially dropped the ball, you're trying to prove a negative, in essence. And the state actually volunteered. You'll see it in the record. It was the state who volunteered, Judge, we've gotten that file before. We'll go get it on a break. The judge tells him to do so, comes back. There's the file on his bench. He looks at it and sees, and you've got it for yourselves to see, he sees everything else in that file, but there's not a certification order in that file. And I guess it's the state's contention that because that they volunteered to go get it and walked it back upstairs, I don't know, somehow that appellant didn't do anything. Appellant was the one who drew the court's attention to that, asked that it be admitted for the record purposes. It might have been better for the state's argument for them not to have done anything at all, quite frankly. But that wasn't the case, and there was sufficient evidence in front of the judge to show that there was not a certification order in that file. The site for the Whitus versus State case that I was referring to is 624 Southwest 2nd, 290. At 291, and that's also quoted in the brief at page 17. In that case, the state argued and quoted extensively from a certification order that was nowhere in the file, and that's where they talk about there's the problem. There is the problem. You can't always presume regularity, and that's the reason why, is because there has to be a certification order in the file, and that's why you have to look to that. As far as the shackling issue goes, I think it would be worthwhile to read just a few pages of the record again, and that's at volume 12, and that's pages 53 through 59, and that's in reply on the reply brief, excuse me, at page 9, and that gives you the order of things, so you can see essentially what happened with the shackling. The trial court takes it upon himself to order that shackling. Appellant objects at that point in time, goes through the full day with him being shackled. They come in the next morning. Judge, please articulate your reasons on the record. Okay. There are generalized safety concerns, his criminal history, and the fact that he's been convicted. Okay.
And something about the family?
There was something about the family. That's correct. Not about appellant. And that the issue has to be specific in the reasons have to be specific to appellant, but there had apparently, according to the record, been some disturbance or assertion of a disturbance with members in the audience, in spectators, appellant's family, not appellant. There was no evidence whatsoever that appellant had been disruptive at any point in time during the trial, had been threatening, had been anything other than sitting there with his lawyer. The transport officers said the same thing, that he did not cause them a single problem at any point in time. And then I think what is the most telling is when appellant asks, and he begs, quite frankly, for the judge at that point, "Judge, let this man sit unencumbered by me." Okay. And he does so then. I mean, that's telling. If you're sure that there is a security concern, that there is a safety concern, that this man might be threatening, that this man might escape, you don't unshackle him. You don't unshackle him after he's been shackled for the full day if you are sure and certain of your ground. And that's the best evidence where I can say that this trial judge in this case was not. And the fact that the shackles were apparent to everybody in that courtroom is what warrants at least new punishment trials in these cases. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Rowland. We appreciate your arguments. Ms. Simmons, we appreciate your arguments, and we appreciate all the briefing in this case. Your case is now submitted, and that concludes our docket for today.